Well, hello there, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with Gibby Labrantes, Stephen Bristol, and Raymond St. Jean. That's coming up on Endeavors. Well, hello there, Endeavors fam. I feel like I am back from the dead a little bit. I calculated, and I think it's been about 8 weeks since I uploaded an episode. I feel like it's been since mid-February, something like that. And I apologize. I feel like I'm not losing motivation. That's the wrong way to put it. But I have a lot of moving parts right now, and I think I just wasn't motivated to put in the time that I wanted to on this show. But now that I've and I'm still living in Slovakia and traveling around, but I feel that now that I'm a little more stable, I can devote myself to this, you know, like I was, you know, as I have been in the past, you know. And I don't think I'll do a show every week. I don't think that's probably feasible with where my life is at, right now, but I'm definitely trying to get back to the, you know, once every couple of weeks, and, you know, more long form interviews that I enjoyed doing so much in the past. But leaving that aside, I'm now starting my 11th week here in Slovakia, and spring is finally upon us. The weather, it's been windy in the mornings, but it's starting to warm up a little bit, so that's what's happening right now. And teaching has been going very, very well, and if you follow me on my personal social media accounts, you will have seen all my updates. But today we have not one, not two, but three great film directors. We have Stephen Bristol, we have Raymond St. Jean, and we have one that I did back in February with Gabriel Abrantes. But we are going to start with my first guest, who is the co-writer and director of the great French language film Dusk for a Hitman, shot in Quebec and based on this true story. Raymond St. Jean carefully crafts an intricate tale using a blend of action and dark humor. The film is Dusk for a Hitman, and this is my interview with Raymond St. Jean. Hello, Raymond. Bonjour, how are we?
Hi. I'm great. And you?
I'm good.
Okay. Your
Speaking
bonjour
of,
was great. Do you speak French?
I'm from Victoria, but my French isn't bad.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Okay, that's cool.
But yeah, I'm in Europe at the moment. So it's just about dusk here. It's just about dusk here appropriately, so.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Speaking of dusk, Dusk for Hitman is the new film, and for people who might see the trailer, it does say inspired by a true story. That could mean a lot of things in film. How true is this story, and how did you hear about it and think this makes a good film?
To me, when you do a fiction inspired by a true event, it's still a fiction. So I think to answer the first part of your question, I think we're trying to be true to the man from all the information we had. We never met anyone in preparation for the screenplay, writing, doing research, but we had interviews. We went to the archives of newspapers, and there were a few books and a few good interviews with him. So we had an idea of who he was, or maybe what he pretended he was, because our basis for the man is that he was a narcissistic and a narcissist, and that he essentially used people to achieve his goals. So how much can we expect the truth from a man like that? I don't know. So we tried to also stay true to the general arc of his story. All the plot points we have are true. He really fell down a Lange chute, in the hotel to save himself. And overall, the arc of the events is true, but we modified things and changed things. But I think all biopics do that, And to be fair, he's not a huge historical figure. It's not Churchill. He's a gangster. So we thought that we have was fair game to use his life to tell a story like we thought we should just tell it. And I forgot the second half of your question.
Oh, I just I, it was I mean, you sort of
You had
answered it. It
another
was just about why you think
part to your
story makes
question.
for a good film.
Oh, you're frozen.
No. Oh, hang on. Sorry. Bad Wi-Fi where I am. One second.
I'm sorry you're frozen.
Yeah. No, I was just saying, what made you
Oh,
think
you.
that you wanted this? What for you, what made this story a good film?
Yeah, like I said, the character was. It's also a story that, was the character was sort of forgotten. It's 40 years ago and it was news at the time, but it was forgotten. But it was such a great character. And some story want are just waiting to be told. You just have to pick them up and they're a good story. So we had this great character, great story, and also a man who, despite all his crimes, ended up doing something useful to society somehow, being a witness in all those these being a witness in court helped to eliminate this gang. So he was a contributor, and there were no witness protection program in Canada at the time. So around him, they built this new witness protection program, and they had to deal with him for him to be a witness. So he made things happen somehow, for what reason deeply? Was it to redemption that we don't know. There's an ambiguity, and we try to keep this ambiguity in the film. He's
You
coming
know,
again.
French Canadians, I think, have a very specific sense of humor, especially when it comes to media entertainment. I'm curious, how much of your sensibility as a French Canadian came out, and how much do you think of sort of Quebec's natural humor came out in this story?
Yeah, it's interesting. You're the first one who bring this up. Well, actually, there are many things there. You know, my co-writer, Martin Girard, wrote most of the dialogues, and he has this way himself of, you know, it comes out like that, like he says. But we tried to imagine dialogues, you know, that these guys would have simply, you know, not being too serious, being extremely cynical about their life and what they do. So it's just a way of, you know, you made them speak like you think they could speak. You know, some people told me, well, gangsters don't talk like. The thing is that it's very difficult to translate in English. The translation of the movie is good, but there are some jokes that just don't work in English. They're impossible to translate. So someone who has an ear and can listen will appreciate some of the dialogues with our, yeah, the kind of, sometimes there's humor in it, but it's done in a very straight way, like if it was the way they talk, you know, that's the thing. And I don't know about the our if my culture at it, you know, that's a good question. I would have to think about that. But of course, it's a Quebec movie, so what comes out of it is our culture. You know, it's our take on a gangster movie, and essentially an American genre, and we do it our way. I guess, yeah.
You know, there have been a lot of great films coming out of Quebec for years, and a lot of great filmmakers, of course, Denis Villeneuve comes to mind, and Jean-Marc Vallée. But it finally feels that like homegrown movies from Quebec are finally starting to feel the love, not only in Canada, but internationally as well. Is there something that you attribute that to as to why Quebec is having its moment now?
That's interesting. There were a few moments in Quebec's history. You know, the 70s, were, as far as filmmaking goes, was a moment. I think what I see is that the film that were financed and produced in the last, you know, since 2020, there's a new wave of filmmaker. So we should use with prudence. But there were new filmmakers. There were some. Some programs helping diversity and women coming to directing. So one of the great things that happened is that we have, I don't know, 10, 15 now young directors, women directors, who bring a new vision to our cinema. So I think that helps, that part of it helps. And I see also a diversity in genre and more risk taken with genre movies. You know, there were in the three last years, I think three or four gangster movies, and there are vampires movies. And, you know, I think the producers are taking more risk on, there are still these comedies and, you know, popular movies aimed at the summer audience. But overall, you know, there are riskier movies that are made now in Quebec, you know. So I think that would help. And, you know, it's the chance to be seen, you know. Luckily, our film was picked up by Saban, and otherwise, you know, the film would have been shown in the US. And so it's a huge market. And I think it's a mixed thing, phenomenon, you know.
Is there something extra special being a Canadian filmmaker making a film in Canada and having it picked up by a US distributor? Does that sort of legitimize it in a different way than if it was just shown in Canada?
Well, it's always fun to get a bigger. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got your question. So it's always interesting to just get a bigger audience, and especially in a genre film like that. You know, I think of, with Westerns, you know, the gangster movie is a definitive American genre. You know, it's a producer of American cinema, and we are influenced. I was influenced by that as a teenager, as a kid. You know, I watched a lot of gangster movie at the time, American gangster movie. So it becomes part of our culture. You know, we speak French, we have a different culture, but we're still North Americans and pretty much influenced by American culture. So to see the reaction of we don't have many critics yet, but many reviews yet, but it's fun to see the reaction. You know, it's totally different from the reaction we had here. Here it was, you know, well received. We found our public, but it was seen like, you know, like another big star movie, big Quebec star movie, trying to be an American movie. But the Americans don't see it that way. It's totally, to them, it's, oh, it's a new angle on the genre, and it's different. They speak French. It's like Goodfellas in French. I get all these comparisons that I find, you know, very touching. But it's this this angle, you know, totally different on our film, and that I find fascinating.
You know, there are so many, you know, good moments, whether they're shoot 'em up or some witty dialogue. Are there one or two scenes that are your favorites or that stand out to you for whatever reason?
Oh my God, that's a tough question. I think I just love what Eric Bruneau did in the film. You know, I think without naming any scenes, I think he's good all through the film. He gives an exceptional performance. You know, it's not mimetism, but he's so much. He became this guy, what we thought this guy was, and I think his portrait is amazing. He just went deep into the character, and I think gives one of his best performances. He's someone to discover, you know, and so that I'm very fond of, you know, the work we did together with all the other actors, but especially Eric, I'm very fond of. And well, I like the film, you know. when you see a film a thousand times, maybe I like the scene where he's about to kill, we don't know if he will do it, his brother in the forest. I think that scene is pretty intense, and I like the forest there and everything. You know, I think it feels right. We even found a forest with a little dump at the end of it, which is so typical of farms in Quebec. So I have this shot at the end where I'm behind the old fridges and old stuff, and so it's nature, but it's still it's spoiled nature. So this shot I like a lot, but it's all, you know, it's pure luck that we found this place, you know, with the field, and it's beautiful scene. I like it, and how it was shot also by Jean-François Lard, our DOP. He did a great job on the film.
You know, there's a lot of action sequences and a lot of scenes involving guns and bullets. And the last couple of years, we've really seen a conversation about that and safety and real guns versus fake guns and all this. What kind of conversations happened on this set in terms of, you know, do we shoot a real gun? Do we shoot a blank? You know, how realistic can we make it look in light of everything that happened on set a couple years ago?
Yeah, well, actually, it was my first time using guns on a film, and pretty early on, you know, I had a scene. We shot a scene that was shot in a scrap yard, where it's a scene that's not in a movie. It was cut, you know. He's shooting at the bottles in a scrap yard, and we use blanks and explosions and everything. And I said, wow, this is so much trouble, you know, and it limits us a lot. So I decided after that to go fully digital on the gunshots, and even with our special effects guy, John Tate, he did most of it with analogic tools. You know, he made a small cannon with real powder and shot the explosions, and you know, he did all that. And what it permits is to have you know, to shoot the people in the face, which you can't do with you know, many times in the film, since these guys were actually executing people. You know, they were not they would shoot them right in the face. So when there's nothing coming out of the gun, you can do whatever you want with it. So it was pretty safe, you know. And we don't have live ammunition on set, real ammunition on set in Canada. It's impossible. You know what happened on this film is in. I can't imagine it happening in Canada. There's no way. There's no way we would have live rounds on set. That's impossible.
Well, the film is Dusk for a Hitman, and it is available on demand and on digital on April the 19th. Raymond Saint-Jean, thank you so much for joining me today. Merci.
Thanks to you. Have a nice trip.
Thank you so much. Ciao.
Bye.
That was my interview with Raymond Saint-Jean. He is the co-writer and director of the new film, Dusk for a Hitman, which is out as of April 19th. From French-Canadian cinema, we move to quote-unquote black cinema with Stephen Bristol, who helms the marvelous new action thriller Breathe, which follows an East Flatbush mother and daughter barely surviving in an oxygen-less world who must band together to protect each other when intruders arrive claiming to know their missing father. It's a beautiful and intricate thriller, and it stars Jennifer Hudson, Mila Jovovich, and Kwevajeni Wallace. It is in theaters and on digital on April the 26th, and this is my conversation with director Stephen Bristol. Yeah, sorry. I'm in the hotel bar. It's a little bit dark. I apologize.
It's all good. It's all good. But it's a pleasure to meet you. How are you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, I'm high up in the mountain, so I have to kind of makeshift Wi-Fi when I can. There. Is that a little bit better?
A little bit better. It's all right, man. It's all right. Let's go.
All right. Stephen Bristol, hello. Thanks for being here. How are you doing today, man?
I'm amazing, man. I'm amazing. It's getting warmer. And I'm happy.
Nice, nice. You have a new film out called Breathe. Very, very intriguing premise. Where did the idea come from for you to sort of use oxygen as a plot line, as almost a metaphor?
That's Doug Simon. You gotta talk to him.
Fair enough, fair enough.
But no, I read that script at the Blacklist, on the Blacklist in 2019. And I thought that, you know, that premise was, I never thought of that one before. I don't think I've ever seen something like that. And I really, that's going to be a very ambitious, you know, movie to do. And I was like, okay, how is this going to work? And then when I read the script, man, I was on the edge of my seat reading. I didn't put the script down. And I said to myself, you know what, I can do this movie. I could really do this movie. And you know, I just wanted to put my own spin on it, you know, because it was like this, the original script was more open for interpretation because Doug had it, you know, on a farm upstate New York, and it didn't really had a strong, you know, strong anchor to it as much besides it just being a straight action thriller. So I said, you know what, I'm making this movie be in Brooklyn with a black family.
Yeah.
And, you know, we found the theme later on. I was reading the script, and we found the theme, you know, of it, you know, being about, you know, young, you know, about protecting the youth because we leave in a planet, we leave in a planet and in a very bad situation for our future generation. And a friend of mine told me about a Native American proverb that goes something like, "We don't inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrowed it from our children." And I just took that and I was like, look, that's the theme of the movie. That's my spin on it. Thunder Road loved it. Capstone loved it. And then ultimately Variants loved it. And I was like, let's go.
You know, whenever these types of movies come out that sort of deal with, the future and a cataclysmic event, there's always, scientists always come down and critique the scientific accuracy or the scientific credibility of this. Is that something you were cognizant of? Is that something you focused on? Is that something you tried to be aware of and work like how this would actually look in a real life situation?
Yes and no. Movies are movies. We can't create dinosaurs. That's what we had Jurassic Park.
Good.
We can't go back in time. That's what we have Back to the Future. We did our best we could. We had a, we had a science, with somebody in science to help us with our research for it. And at the end of the day, and same thing, I also had a scientist help me with my first feature, see yesterday about time travel. At the end of the day, we can only do, so much because it's a fictional setting. But the most important thing is not about science of it all. It's about what we're trying to say through the science fiction. Obviously Jurassic Park is about we can't play God, Back to the Future, you can't, that what it is. But this movie is more about warning the audience about, if we all do not pitch in, we're leaving this planet to the next generation a hellhole for our next generation. And that's not fair to them. Everybody's responsible as well. Everybody is responsible. So, what can we do to get there? I think the trick is though, the trick is was to make sure moment by moment, piece by piece, it makes sense so we can move the story forward. So yes and no.
One thing that really struck me about it was the aesthetic and sort of the tone and the color scheme that is present throughout the film. What kind of conversations went into that with your cinematographer? And was that something that you shot in camera or was that done in editing? How did that look come about?
But Felipe Verde-Rey and I, we go back many, many years, and we've always been critical about the look and feel of the film. So, but this particular film, the idea is even what's in the script, actually, even the red hue of the world, it was actually in the script as well, because a Earth that's devoid of oxygen is not really Earth. It's another planet. And if there was no oxygen, the atmosphere would be red. So it would feel like Mars. How do we convey that? And well, obviously we got to shoot, in red, and we don't want to like have the color all be done in post. So Felipe figured out what kind of filters to use on camera, so we can shoot it on camera, those filters, so it can help us alleviate the coloring process in post. The difficulties of the process of post, it was quite helpful, but at the end of the day, it's like we didn't choose an orange reddish hue just because it looks cool. We did it because it what does the Earth look like as an alien planet if it's devoid of oxygen? So that was very important.
Did making a movie like this make you think about what you would do if you were in this situation?
No, I was trying to I wrote a movie just have a fun movie, man. My ass probably be dead. Be honest with you. And the same thing with first the movie, see you yesterday. I don't want to go back in time. I don't want to create time travel. What happened in the past? That's it. Move forward. And since we're moving forward to, since we're moving forward to another apocalypse that we all create, I guess my ass is grass. So.
You mentioned at the top that you're going to make this movie your way and you wanted to make it with a black family. So I take it that wasn't in the original script. And obviously,
of course not.
Obviously, it's your experience being a black person, but how do you think that, how much does that change the story? Like, how different would this film be if it was a white family or a Latino family or an Asian family? What does the black identity bring to a story like this?
It creates a sense for a certain audience to finally see a black family survive an apocalyptic event or in a traumatic event. Because usually when you have these movies, black folks are the first ones to get killed off. So we finally have an image of a beautiful, successful, smart black family. The sense of the film, which we've never seen a lot. Black scientists, we don't see that in action adventure films.
Right.
To see that as a forefront to finally survive is very important. Plus, Jennifer Hudson and Kalman make a hell of a couple on screen. So, you got that.
And it's interesting you mentioned those two because obviously they both got their start in music and, you know, they're now fantastic actors. Of course, Jennifer Hudson, I think, has won an EGOT. Kalman's made a lot of really great films. Is there something inherently different about directing musicians or performers or people who otherwise didn't get their start in the business and transitioned versus somebody like Quvenzhané and Mila who have been doing it their whole lives?
Every actor is different. Everyone needed their own love. You know what I'm saying? Like it's, you know, I've worked with people who were never had, who were actors never acted really before. So, not really. Mila is different from Sam. Sam is different from Provision. Everybody needed their own thing. So, you know, it's musician or not, as long as you're dedicated, you have some kind of training. It's very important. You know, acting is a very specific art, and it's not easy. You know, if someone asked me to act, I'm like, hell no, that's I'd be terrified. So no. For me personally, people will say yes, but for me personally, you know, everybody's different. So every actor is different. So no.
There's a lot of great scenes in a film like this, but are there one or two that stand out as your favorite? Maybe when you were filming them or when you saw them in post, you're just like, yes, this is it.
My favorite scene. I don't want to give any spoilers. I can't tell you because I don't want to give any spoilers away. Well, because you know I can't. There is one scene that I love. It's towards the end.
Okay.
Of the film. when Tess Lucas finally. I'm giving away. That's hard. It's
always difficult talking about something without giving away too much detail.
Yeah. But I would say this. There is one scene that I am at all at both Mila's performance and Quvenzhané's performance. And I can't tell you what scene that is because I would just give it away. I was just at all, you know. It was that was one of the most difficult scenes to shoot, but it was their performance was brilliant.
Well, the film is Breathe, and I believe it comes out in theaters and on digital on April the 26th.
Yes, sir.
Yes. I encourage all the listeners to go see it. It's a really good film. It's a really good take on sort of the apocalypse and nuclear waste. Stefan Bristol, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers, sir. Wonderful.
And once again, that was my interview with director Stefan Bristol. He is the director of Breathe, which is in theaters and on digital on April 26th. Well, we have another horror thriller to round out this trilogy of directors. Amelia's Children was released back in the beginning of March, and it follows a man named Edward who searches for a biological family in Portugal. He finds a villa and reunites his long-lost mother with his long-lost mother and twin, but their shared past holds a dark secret that will forever change his understanding of identity and origins. It stars Bridget Lundy Payne, Carlotto Cotta, Annabella Morea, and Alba Batista. It was written and directed by Gabriel Abrantes and was released on March 1st. This is my conversation with Gabriel about Amelia's Children.
All right, I'll record on my end as a backup. You have 15 minutes.
All right.
Thanks, Rachel.
Hi, Gabe. Dan. Hey, how's it going?
Going okay.
Abrantes, do I have that right?
Yeah, it's great.
All right. I speak a little bit of Spanish, so.
Great.
Gabriel Abrantes, welcome. Thanks for being here today. You have a great new film out, Amelia's Children. Where did the genesis for this idea come from?
Well, I knew I wanted to make a horror film. I'd done another feature that I co-directed with Daniel Schmidt called Diamantino, and it was supposed to be this sort of outlandish rom-com. Like, Daniel and I were really into the 40s, you know, golden era Hollywood rom-coms, like by Capra and Cukor and Sturges. And we made our own, like, demented, twisted, weird version of that. Like, it's still about a couple that doesn't like each other and then gets back together. So it has the basic DNA of a rom-com, but then everything else is totally bonkers in it or something. And I really enjoyed that, of like leaning into a specific genre, especially a genre that was like, let's say, a light genre or something not very serious. But then the film like actually talks about the rise of fascism in Europe or refugees in Europe coming from Africa, etc. So it's a weird, demented film that talks about a lot of the, like, you know, relevant topics today in the news, but using this really, you know, goofy and silly and light form of the rom-com. And then with horror, I sort of wanted to do the same, but maybe lean more into genre or something. Like, I wanted to do genre again, but have it respect maybe some of the conventions a little more. And as a challenge to myself, like, can I actually get a scare out of it? Can I keep the suspense up? But really, and so to come up, you know, that's the basis. I just wanted to do a horror film, do a scary movie, and lean into that genre. And then when I started coming up with ideas, quickly I got to the idea of like a mom and a son that finds out his mom is a witch or has something special, weird about her. And I really started, you know, getting into that idea, and a mom who's like unwilling to let her kids like grow up and is protective. And that, you know, can be so easily parallel to, you know, so many people, you know, like I went to a restaurant where there was a guy and he's serving, and we're like, is there a, you know, French fries today? And he's like, no, mommy hasn't made them yet. But he's like, you know, this like 55-year-old person. And it really reminded me of like, Perkins and Psycho or something, this relationship of the of mom-son being way too close or something. And so I started getting really into that, and this mom that's manipulating her children to sort of keep it that way in some way. And that's sort of the genesis that took me into the film.
In a film like this, how do you simultaneously go over the top without going over the top?
Yeah, that we just premiered here in New York Friday at ISC. It was really nice, and I had a bunch of friends there, and we talked about that in Q&A a bit, which is like when I started writing the script and started getting into some comedic sequences, which happened by luck. I wasn't ex you know, it wasn't a now maybe after this film has become much more clear to me that whatever film I do, it's got to have some level of camp or comedy in it, because that's just is what I like and sort of where I lean into naturally. But when I was writing the script, I was writing scary scenes and trying to be scary, and that was a challenge and curious and interesting. But then all of a sudden I started writing like funny things and laughing, you know, like something that the mom says that's like really inappropriate, or yeah, just sometimes just like a funny song that comes on, and I started laughing a lot, and then that mix started, you know, being really electric for me. But then on set, like a lot of the actors were quite confused, because I didn't pitch it to the actors as like a horror comedy or just a comedy. I was like pitching it as we're making a horror movie, and they're like, wait, why are you laughing so much? Because behind the camera, like we'd call cut and I'd laugh a lot. So I think that was hard for the actors and everything, but I feel like, you know, Amelia, the actress who did Amelia, Annabella Moreira, she really got it. She's the one who questioned it most, like seemed most insecure about it. But like the scene that she meets Riley, that Amelia meets Riley, it's such a mix of comic and horrific. I just really love that scene. It really hit the tone that I was after. And then in terms of like striking the balance, we had to we cut a lot of scenes in the editing room in the search of like the most efficient edit in a way. And I'm really sad that a lot of funny scenes, you know, are left on the editing room floor. But I think that's where you find that tone. Like, I think we could have gone funnier and kept those in, and maybe that would have impacted the characters where we'd take them a little less seriously. So that's sort of where, if you have any place where you can sort of do a balancing act, it's the editing room and push it more one way or another. Like a friend had been telling me, like, ah, you should put voiceover to really push it towards comedy or something. And the suggestion was like it would be Amelia's voiceover sort of mocking Ed, you know, her son.
Yeah.
And which I meant, like, you know, that idea sounds really funny to me. But I was like, I know that's too much. That'll then, you know, we won't get a single scare out of it. Like, and I still want it to be in both those worlds.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned comedy because I feel like, especially lately, we're seeing a lot more crossover between the horror and the comedy world. You know, like Jordan Peele had a lot to do with that, and
Totally, yeah.
comedy actors are very good at sort of horror performances. Why do you think the relationship between those two genres is so unique?
I have no idea, but yeah, like Bong Joon-ho, who like did Parasite, it's also a mix of like horror thriller with comedy. But I was always into it. Like, I really love Silence of the Lambs or Blue Velvet by Lynch, and like both those films I find funny. A lot of people don't, you know, they're just horrific. But like Hannibal Lecter, to me, when he's like spitting out his tongue at Clarice, like I find it really funny and campy and over the top. It gives me that, you know, a smile on my face. And yeah, even the guy who did Barbarian, like he had a comedy troupe before, like that did sketches, you know, and that's where he came from. He actually said something, I can't remember what he said, but that's about that, about why comedy and horror might have a link. But yeah, I don't know. It's like I don't know what links those two things together. For me, I like it, but I like it when it isn't full comedy, you know, like when it's when we have something like Shaun of the Dead or something that's really comedy, less horror or something, it has less of an effect for me. I had never seen Evil Dead and I just watched it recently, and that was like a great mix to me, because I'm still getting scared in some of the scenes because I'm pretty easily scared, but so I like that.
As a, you know, as a fan of the genre and someone who makes horror, what makes a good scare?
It's a mystery, and I think it's like, you know, like musicians, like how do you compose a song or make a write a song or whatever, and they're like, ah, the melody is at the heart of it, and then they're like, how do you make a melody, and it's like, it's really intuitive, we can't tell you. You know, like what's his name, there's an interview with Hans Zimmer and he's like, yeah, the tune is the heart of it, the tune is the heart of it, and it's like, I can't tell you how to make a good tune, it's like you improvise it on the piano. And there are rules to like making a melody or something that you can study, but you know, oftentimes if you follow those, they'll give you sort of stale melodies or something. And I think with horror and scares, it's similar. Like we were actually struggling with some of our scares. I really like a scare in Mulholland Drive that's like the guys go to the back corner and this dumpster woman like jumps out. It's got one of the loudest like, zinger hits when she shows up. And it always frightened the hell out of me. And so I was looking at this and like there was no formula to it. It's just like people walk down a hallway, scary thing pops out. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. And a bunch of stuff on YouTube works like that as well. It's just like empty hallway and then something jumps out at the camera. But I did, a very simple scare like that and it wasn't working. And I was wondering why. So then I like looked up online and I found this like, I think it's the Verge article or something. And it's like the anatomy of a jump scare. And it talks about like a three act structure to a jump scare, which is, and they relate it to that film, The Prestige, which has the three acts of like a magic trick or something. And it's basically like there's loud noise. So like you have some threat that's established. The character goes to like check out, what's in the closet, like what's the loud noise, and then opens the closet and it's empty. That's the second act. It's like, oh, everything's safe again. And then when the character's safe again, the character jumps out or whatever. And if we look at like, I think there's two really short videos, like the host, not the feature, but the short that it was based on, and Lights Out, also the short it was based on, both use this three act structure. I don't know if consciously or unconsciously, but that really helped us for a lot of the scares afterwards. That helped, at least they were functional.
And how much of that do you find comes out in editing, and how much of that is present in the actual shooting?
In the shooting, you have no idea, and even the editing, you have no idea. You try to show it to people, but it's like it's so mangled because it doesn't have mix or sound or so it's hard to judge whether somebody watching like a temp edit, whether it should scare them or not because it's just so underworked. And I remember the guy from It Follows talking about this. Actually, the soundtrack artist from It Follows, and he was talking about they're in the mix, and they're putting everything up to 11. Like the noise, the soundtrack, everything as scary as possible, and they're like not scared because they've seen it a million times, and they just said like we have absolutely no clue whether it's going to work or not, and then basically it just has to get to theaters and or wherever, VOD, and if people are scared, they're scared. If they're not, they're not. But the there's some producer who had this line. It's like you absolutely have no idea whether a film's good until you got hot seats. Yeah, hot seats is like people in the seats. And like no amount of like pre-screening or whatever will actually tell you whether it's working or not,
Horror films are always filled with great specific moments. Were there one or two scenes or moments for you that really stuck out for you just because they were really well done, or maybe they were unexpected?
From other films or this film?
From your film.
My film, I really love that scene that I was mentioning, the Riley meets Amelia scene, because just like when I saw it edited, that's one of those scenes that like, the temp edit that was being done while we're shooting by the assistant editor, it functioned. And I was like, oh, this is the movie, this is the tone of the movie. And so that I really love, and I love it to this day. And then the third act, I really got into the like action part of shooting. And I feel like it really, hits in the film, like it's working well. So I'm proud of that. And, the stunt guy who worked with us, like we were just playing with like action figures to choreograph everything. And it was so cool. You just feel like a little kid, like, and then they jump here and they crash on the ground. And you're just doing this like little, you're just playing like a little kid with action figures, but coming up with, and it was just so cool. Like he kept saying, like, no, they can't do that next. They gotta escalate. It's gotta get worse. And that's exactly what like this author that I love, George Saunders, who has like a Substack that I follow with like how to write kind of things. And he's just like, the rule of a story is it has to escalate. So like the same rules are being applied to like the stunt choreography. So anyway, I had a lot of fun doing the third act, the more action kind of stuff.
What are the challenges for you as a director directing somebody playing more than one role in the same film?
So it's hard. I think it's really hard for an actor because you either have your stunt double next to you, I guess not stunt double, your double that's like giving you the lines, etc. And it's just, I think, really disorienting. I think you can get much more into a methody, like kind of into the scene and into the character if you don't have that. So I think it's hard. For me as a director, obviously that's hard because I'm there with the actor and I'm like trying to help them do the best possible. But then for me, the technical part and also the logistical part was what I really regretted, which is as soon as you're setting up green screen two or three times during a day of shoot and lighting it and having your actors switch costumes and coming back and making sure everything's like synchronized and working, you're lo eating a lot of time. And for a movie that's sort of like, it's a smaller film that I made with my partner and made with our sweat and tears, and that seemed like a lot of time that was precious and we should have used in another way. So that was something that was quite challenging.
Well, the film is Amelia's Children, and I believe it is out now as of March the 1st.
Yeah.
Yes. Gabriel Brantes, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Bye.
And once again, that was my conversation with Gabriel Brantes. His film Amelia's Children was released on March the 1st. My thanks to Gabriel, my thanks to Raymond St. John, and my thanks to Stefan Bristol. You can check out their films Breed and Dusk for Hitmen that came out on April 18th and April 26th, respectively. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye, everybody. Bye.